Welcome to the Wicked Wallflowers Club. I'm Jenny Nordback.
And I'm Sarah Hawley. We are here with amazing editor Angela James. We discuss her tenure at Carina Press, how editors and publishing imprints should promote diversity, and the editing services she offers. As a special treat, Jenny got a first pages critique from Angela of an early draft of her novel. It completely changed how Jenny thinks about her writing, and in the time since this conversation, she's made significant changes based on Angela's advice. So without further ado, here is our interview with Angela James.
We are joined this morning by Angela James, who is a beloved editor in the community. We have discovered people have very strong feelings. So thank you for being here during a conference that is kind of weird for you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I don't know if I've ever been described as beloved before, but I have been in the community for almost 2 decades. So I suppose I'm very familiar for some people.
Well, so the reason I say people have feelings is the elephant in the room is that when you and I scheduled this interview, you were with Harlequin and were like the head of Carina, yes?
So I was up until as of this interview about 10 days ago, the editorial director of Carina Press. We founded Carina Press at Harlequin in 2009 and I had been there since the beginning. And originally, I was the only editor on Carina Press. So probably for 4 or 5 years, I was the only person working on Carina Press until we created a few more editorial positions there. So I think people very much related me with Carina.
Yeah.
We've published everything. Now, Carina is romance and mystery. But in the past, we have done everything from thrillers and science fiction and fantasy, women's fiction. So it's touched a lot of different genre fiction.
And I think one of the things that people loved so much about the work you were doing is how inclusive it was and like just how much of an effort you were making to do that. And it seemed like you were succeeding. And
we definitely were succeeding. I think in the past year, especially seen a lot more diversity and inclusion in the release schedule. And, you know, we're scheduled for a few years out and you're going to see them continue to release a lot of very diverse, inclusive books across ethnicity and LGBTQ, people with disabilities, really working to just make sure that we're including everybody. But also it was important to us for authors to know that as an editorial team, we were a safe space to land, making sure that people know they don't have to tell us their marginalization. We are not going to use it as a marketing hook unless the author said, I want this to be part of my platform. You know, you being own voices isn't our marketing tool. So I think there were a lot of factors involved in making the imprint something that people would feel was a welcoming space.
That's such a good point, where I feel like the own voices is supposed to be an opportunity to be inclusive of those voices, but it's almost become a like, we want own voices, but we want to be able to talk about that it's own voices. Yeah. And it is like we want to promote it as such, which is good because it gets the word out that it's own voices, but also you may not want to publicize that. Like you might just want to be able to tell your story.
Right. And it might not be safe for you to publicize that in many different ways, not just for the LGBTQ community, but in other ways as well. I attended a great panel yesterday. It was moderated by Elle Penelope, and there were 4 people on the panel, including Cam Jackson and Anna Szabo, Raina Vaus, and Lorealis Eakes, I think. And they had some great conversation about writing diversely and whose story is it to tell. And some of the questions that they talked about were, how can you tell when somebody is pandering? Mm-hmm. And they were really talking about when it's pandering, when it's including inclusivity in many media forms, whether it's books or movies or TV shows. But sitting in the audience listening, I thought that also applies to publishers as well. Are you doing it authentically because you know that this is how publishing needs to change? Or are you doing it because everybody's looking to see if you are? And so one of the things that we wanted to make sure that we were doing at Carina is not pandering. Mm. And I think that that means that you have to have people who have a passion for the work, for all of the work that they publish.
Yeah, it's like ideally own voices should be behind the scenes in a sense, where it ought to be something where the publishers are saying, okay, we need to diversify our list, not mm-hmm. for the sake of like selling it, but when it starts becoming this thing where you're like, oh, the own voices books are popular, well, I guess I better get one of those.
Yeah.
So I like that approach to making sure that you are not pandering and not using it as marketing.
Yeah.
And it is hard when we used to say to each other, because we're a team of three, we're a team of three white women, and we are not diverse ourselves. We're not own voices. We're not marginalized, except perhaps in terms of being women or weight. And so we said, you know, we're not in a position to hire other employees, but one of the ways that we made sure that we had diverse voices on the team was hiring a team of freelance editors who can look at the books and work on the books and recommend for acquisition the work and be part of the community. And so there were definitely ways in which we knew we had privilege and we had to like figure out how to work beyond that.
Did you arrange for sensitivity reads for manuscripts you acquired?
It's really interesting that you ask about sensitivity reads, because on the panel that I attended yesterday, this was a topic of conversation. And one of the things that we really encourage our authors to do is write from a place of authenticity. Mm-hmm. You know, you always talk about doing your research, but one sensitivity reader is only one voice. And one voice is not the voice for an entire community. Mm-hmm. So we did do some sensitivity reads, but we were really looking for authors who also were understanding what they were writing, mm-hmm. and either had a seat at the table or clearly had an insight into the culture that they were writing, not doing tokenism in their characterization. And it's hard as an editor. As an editorial team, we can't have editors from all communities. That it's just not possible to have one editor who's non-binary and an editor who's Asian and an editor who's South Asian and an editor who's African-American and an editor who's, you know, Asian Canadian. You can't cover all of the communities, so you really have to be aware of your own internal biases. You have to be aware of microaggressions and how those can come out. And there's certainly things that we would miss, but I think we were always trying to educate ourselves and our teams to try and do better.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is as much as you can do, like just being aware that you don't know everything and that you have those biases, even when you're trying not to,
right.
They're in there and like you might have the reaction, but catch it and acknowledge it and try to do better next time.
We had a training at one of my old jobs for unconscious bias. And it was like sensitivity training, but then they had you take a test where you're responding to various things, and not a single person showed up unbiased. And I remember doing like,
right.
Oh, like I am pausing extra here. I am actually, and I forget what, it was some university. And it's basically you click and you associate words with pictures and things like that. And just the idea that every single person has bias and isn't aware of it. But the more that you realize that you are not a perfect being, the easier it gets to sort of call that out before it affects other people.
You do a workshop called Before You Hit Send.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Oh, Before You Hit Send is, I suppose, almost a decade old. It started just before I started working at Harlequin. And it came about because somebody emailed me and said, hey, we have, we're looking for a workshop. Excuse me. We're looking for a workshop on a chapter loop about self-editing. Would you do one? And I was like, yeah, that'll be super easy. And I started putting it together and I thought, well, this is really long and a lot of information. So the first time I did it, it was 1 week for a chapter loop. And I looked at it and I thought, you know, I can probably do something with this. So over the 10 years, It's morphed from a 1 week course into approximately 5 weeks. It's now self-guided. You can go register on for the course. It's online, and a one lesson a day releases to you. And it goes, I call it a writing and self-editing course, because it goes from everything from, you know, small editing tips and using your word processing program, to talking about punctuation and dialogue tags and passive voice and adverbs, and then into the bigger things like pacing. Pacing is like one lesson, and then I break pacing out into like also a separate workshop, because it's such a huge thing. Mm. My thing with Before You Hit Send has always been, there are no rules. Everybody always talks about writing rules, and I did air quotes, quote unquote rules. And I don't really believe that there's writing rules. I think there's guidelines. I think there's well-intended advice, but what works for one person doesn't work for everybody else. And sometimes it's bad advice, like never use adverbs. Well, everybody thinks an adverb is a word that ends in L-Y and it's bad. And yes, adverbs can be detrimental to your writing, but also they're a part of the English language. Mm-hmm. They tell you, you know, like how something happened, when something happened, where something happened. And it would be impossible to write without adverbs. So when somebody says, don't ever use adverbs in your writing, they're actually not understanding what they're saying. So I don't harp on rules.
It's not rules, but like, again, awareness.
It's awareness. Like
you can break the rules,
yes,
as long as you,
yes,
are aware that you're doing it and you're doing it consciously.
Correct. It's awareness. I say, you know, everybody says, oh, but, you know, so-and-so head hops. Well, sure, kind of, but it works for their voice. Mm-hmm. And what works for one person's voice might not work for your voice. And so if somebody says you're head hopping, you have to figure out, is it because they just think that head hopping is bad and you can't do it, or is it actually intrusive to the reading experience? And there's that's two different things. So if somebody is pointing out something in your work just because they have been told you can't do it, that's writing and editorial advice that you might have to think about. If somebody is saying, this is head hopping and I'm pointing it out because it really pulled me out of this moment, that's advice you might actually want to consider more seriously. So there's a difference when you're looking at what people tell you not to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, because voice is so important for authors.
Yes.
And I feel like a lot of time people are like, well, let's just strip your prose down as much as possible. Like, let's do some Hemingway model and it'll all be like short, simple sentences and like high art. But that completely takes away the eccentricities of voice that make things mm-hmm. so interesting.
Yeah, I think I talk a lot about voice. Both in the workshop, when I'm mentoring editors, and when I'm working with authors, I talk a lot about voice, because voice is so important. And so many readers are reading for author voice and story. They're not reading for mechanics. Mm-hmm. And so if you get too focused on mechanics and strip the prose down and take out all the adverbs, you can actually take away somebody's voice, and that can lose some of the magic for the reader.
Yeah. And what, when you say like you get a lesson a day, is it's like a written lesson? Yes. And you can like work through it at your own pace. And if you can't do one a day, you could save it for the weekend or whatever.
That's right. So what I try to do is I say one a day, but if there's like a topic, say like dialogue tags, then you're going to get all three lessons on dialogue tags maybe. And so it's a written lesson. It comes with basically just I'm like I'll talk about the subject, and then I include past Q&As from the courses, so people can see past questions that people have asked, because that provides further insight into the subject. And then I usually try and assign a like some sort of work, like how do you apply this to your manuscript, or how do you look for this in your manuscript, so that people can actually deep dive into their manuscripts and have a little bit of structure and direction when they're going through the workshop. You have access for roughly 3 months. I say 3 months, but then I have to go in and remove everybody. So usually I just let people stay in there for longer. So if you can't get to it right away, you do have time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm curious how you got into editing to begin with, and specifically in the romance space.
It all started with Allura's Cave, as many things digital and erotic romance do. I actually have a degree in occupational therapy. I worked as an occupational therapist in mental health for 7 years. I did group and individual setting therapy. And I was working as an occupational therapist, and I was a very avid reader. I've always been a huge reader. I read millions of words a year. And I discovered Allura's Cave actually through RT Magazine. Do you guys remember RT Magazine when the magazine came out? Mm-hmm. So, oh my gosh, it's like, you know, 15, 16, 17 years ago, they used to have RT Romantic Times used to have an actual magazine. And that was like my source of all recommendations for books at the time, because there wasn't a lot of, there was no social media. There were some listservs. And I discovered the listservs through Allura's Cave. And so in the Romantic Times magazine, they would break out recommendations by genre. So you'd have like contemporary and paranormal and science fiction. And they reviewed Allura's Cave titles. And at that time, it was impossible to find erotic romance. That Allura's Cave really brought that to the forefront. And it was hard to find on the bookshelves, paranormal in particular. Mm-hmm. And so I started downloading Allura's Cave's titles. I joined the Allura's Cave Yahoo group. Really dating myself. And I was interacting with all of the authors, and the editors were on this Yahoo group. And I got friendly with one of the editors, Brianna St. James, who worked there. And she was like, oh, you should take the proofreading test and be a proofreader. And I was like, okay, like everybody, I was like, I can find typos. I could be a proofreader. And that's what I did. I started as a proofreader for Allura's Cave. And then I did that for a few years. And I was doing some freelance work with some authors like Mandy Roth and JC Burton. And I got pregnant. And I knew I wanted to take a year off from my job. And somebody said, oh, hey, this person is starting a company called Samhain, and she needs an editor. Would you be interested? I said, yeah, I'm going to have some time on my hands. Newborn babies don't take any time. And
why do we all think this?
Everybody thinks that. But that's what I did. I started Samhain. I worked as the executive editor there for 5 years. And I just never went back to occupational therapy.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's all because of a Yahoo group. So random.
But you've been working from home that whole time then.
I have been working from home since my daughter was born. Yeah, since she's going to be 15 this year. So 15 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's funny how I don't think anything of like writers doing that. But for some reason, I'm like, oh, whoa, that's crazy. But it's the same fucking thing. Like,
it's, well, yeah, it is. And I think as writers discover, especially if they go from an office job to writing full time, it takes you have to have structure. It takes some willpower, and you have to have buy-in from your family. Because when I first started, I was working like out of our dining room or something. You know, I didn't have an office. And then we took the playroom and made it into an office eventually. But you have to tell yourself, I'm sitting at my desk and I'm working. I'm not doing the dishes. I'm not doing laundry. I'm not worried about grocery shopping. I'm actually at work. I'm at work. That can be really hard to do. And then you have to convince everybody in your life that just because you're at home, you are not here for the dishes, the laundry, going to pick somebody up, running errands. Yeah. You're actually at work. So there's some dedication involved in working from home. But now I'm like, I'm actually an introvert. I really do well on my own. I think it would be hard to go back to an office environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, especially the way offices are shifting now, where it's like all open format.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Even like, this isn't your desk space, it's all fluid desk spaces. And I remember when my office went to that, I was like, fuck off. Like, I'm this little creature that needs my like tiny cave where I can like know I'm going to be in the same, like I use the same bathroom stall when I go into bathrooms. Yeah. Like I have to have my spot.
Yeah. I mean, I think they've done studies that the open plan office space doesn't really do well for almost anyone.
Yeah.
No, I always hated it because it would just be noise and it would be, yeah. someone would be blasting music and I would just be like freaking out. Like I can't do it.
Yeah. I am just a person who like, if we're sitting in a hotel bar and I'm talking to you, I'm absolutely paying attention, but I'm also looking around because I'm not used to all of that movement and activity around me. And so I'm like just like hyper aware of things that are happening around me because I'm used to being in a quiet office where I don't like, I don't see anybody in meetings. Like you have video conferences and you have phone calls, but I'm seeing my husband and daughter for days on end.
Yeah.
It's definitely been interesting coming to RWA every year. It feels like Jenny and I are both like little creatures that need space. And
he's like tiny, obsessive, compulsive. Like,
yeah. And when we are here and sort of putting on the performative, like, I am going to fake being an extrovert for like 5 days. Yeah. And like, I am exhausted. It's day four. And I just want to crawl in a corner and die because it's just a lot.
It is a lot.
I'm going to go home and I'm not going to try not to see people for like a week and I'll just sleep and ugh.
It is a lot. And, you know, when you think about the conference, it's like, what, 2,000 of us and probably 90% are introverts.
Yep.
And then you encounter the one person I was talking to. I'm Colleen Lindsay from Amazon. She's their publicity manager. And she said, I am like 98% extrovert. And I said, yes, you are. Because every person that walked by, she said, hey, do you know Angela James? And would talk to them and introduce us. And I just thought, I'm just going to like carry you around in my pocket with me at conferences and help me meet people.
Yeah, you need like your buddy extrovert.
You do need your buddy extrovert.
Yeah. Oh, man, I mean, this conference is in the middle of Times Square, which is like for a conference full of introverts feels like a big choice. Like I almost had a panic attack last night after the party going home and I'm on the subway or I'm trying to get to the subway and just like crowds of people and neon and flashing lights. And I was like about to hyperventilate and die.
I mean, if you've never been to Times Square and you just don't realize that just trying to get down the sidewalk, you are actually elbow to elbow with people.
Yeah.
And there's no personal space.
None.
And you're surrounded. You are surrounded. It's very overwhelming. It's lots of stimulation from the lights and the noise and the people. You're right. It's a choice.
So one of the talk you do a variety of like talks that you'll give at people's like chapter meetings or like you are available to come and speak and use those experiences. And I noticed on your website that one of the ones that you do is like a cold read of people's first couple of pages of their manuscript and you critique it.
Yes.
So I emailed Angela and was like, hey, I'm just batshit enough to want to do this in a recording. It's work to me. Like, it's not personal. It's fine to critique it. So I was like, hey, you want to do this on a podcast? And she's like, yeah, let's do it. So Sarah doesn't know this, but I have the first couple pages of my manuscript.
Yeah.
But you have to read it.
I have to read it?
Yeah. So that because I'll do it in like practiced. I know the words. It needs to be read as a reader would read it, which would be encountering it for the first time.
I'm reading it out loud?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
And so you're going to read it out loud. So how this normally works in a workshop setting, I get one. How it normally works in a workshop setting is we ask for people to turn in anonymously their first 2 to 3 pages. It just depends. I think we have 3 pages here?
Yeah, and we can cut it short if we need to.
Okay. And we ask them to put the word count, the genre, and the market that they're aiming for at the top, because a lot of that can determine how you critique something. And the idea here is to give anonymous feedback. Now, I know this is your manuscript, so I'm still going to be honest.
It's fine. I can take it.
And sometimes there's a lot to say. Sometimes there isn't very much to say. I didn't bring a pen, so I can't like do my like normal marking things. But normally while people are reading them, I'll be making notes and marking.
Do you want a pen?
No, that's okay. Okay. I think I'll remember. And then I give feedback. And sometimes this is I just do this by myself. I know RWA just did one of these on Wednesday with a panel of I think agents and editors.
Yeah.
So
did you see it?
I didn't see it.
I wanted to, but it wasn't.
Yeah, here yet. I didn't see it. Authors tend to really love these because we're only going to get one here. But when you do a group of 10 to 15, you actually can start to see the patterns that an agent or an editor might see in unsolicited manuscripts. Mm. Patterns of like starting in the wrong place, muddy point of view. Patterns often do emerge. So we won't see that here, but it's fun to do it in a group setting. Very nerve-wracking for the authors. I've always understood that. But most agents and editors are always going to try and be kind and constructive. I like it. I've always liked it.
I feel like you should start a podcast just doing that. People send them in. I would totally listen to that.
Yes, that was actually something that I had talked about, sometime in the last year. I said, it would be really neat to have a cold reads podcast. So, you know, I do have some time on my hands now. So, you know, maybe that's something that I'll do. The reason that Sarah has to read it and not you is because you read it, you're going to see it the way it is on the page.
Mm-hmm.
Jenny would see it how she sees it in her head.
Yeah.
So that's why you always have somebody read it who's not familiar.
Okay.
No pressure. Don't fuck it up, Sarah.
So start by reading you don't have to read the title, but read the rest.
Okay. 106K words, contemporary romance, forever Avon Berkeley. That's the ideal thing. All right. I'd had a fucking long day. I started my shift as a flight attendant and ended as Catwoman. My line of work was never dull. It was already 2 a.m. and I was beyond ready to go home, crawl into my comfy bed, and sink into the bliss of oblivion for a few hours before I had to start it all over again. My phone went off with an urgent appointment alert. Fuck no, I said aloud, glancing at it. They were seriously expecting me to take one more client tonight. I opened the alert to see if the date was a typo, but it didn't have the original scheduling email attached and contained almost no information about the session. It simply said, VIP, first timer, back entrance, escort directly to penthouse, 1 hour with option to extend. Great. Someone with an ego and extra fear of getting caught. We kept a low profile and had such focus on privacy for our clients that we rarely honored special VIP requests. Our standard level of service was VIP. We were the most elite house of BDSM fantasy in the world, priding ourselves on discretion, and the accompanying price tag meant all of our clients were VIP in one form or another. The last time I had a client flagged this way, he was the sitting U.S. vice president. I texted the dungeon owner to let her know in no uncertain terms that I wasn't taking the session even if it was the Queen of England. Anyone who is impolite enough to schedule a last-minute appointment at 2 a.m. with the option to extend for fuck's sake wasn't worth dealing with. We didn't even normally schedule appointments with less than 24 hours notice and approval from the dominatrix who was being requested. I knew the owner, Victoria, was awake because she was the one who approved the appointment on my behalf, but she still hadn't responded to me when the alarm went off to let me know that my client had arrived and was waiting in the penthouse. It was with resigned frustration that I glanced in the dressing room mirror to pull my disheveled black hair into a bun. I hadn't been concerned about making a mess of it in my previous session as I gallivanted about as Catwoman since I thought I was finished for the night. I wiped the smudged eyeliner from under my eyes and carefully reapplied my signature red Wicked Queen lipstick. My phone buzzed again with a text from security. Client in penthouse wants to know when you'll be up. I had to delete my response twice before sending, presently, thanks. It wasn't Pierre's fault, the client was high maintenance. I swiped my key fob to access the elevator. Victoria had special fobs made that were designed to look like antique keys, and we wore them as a necklace so we didn't detract from our costumes with a clunky badge. The matching one she wore was adorned with sapphires because she always had to one-up the rest of us. There was also a Bluetooth panic button built into the key should things go awry. Every detail here was meticulously considered to bring about fantasies for our clients that felt real. There was a room specially designed for just about any scenario you could come up with. A schoolroom equipped with desks and every detail you would expect from a functioning classroom. A medical exam room completely outfitted with real medical equipment. An actual dungeon in the basement. A traditional office space, and on and on and on. We even had spare rooms that could be customized if necessary, one of which was currently set up as an airplane cockpit. There was a professional set designer on staff who was available to work with clients ahead of time to make sure the space we played in matched their every whim, and I mean every whim. A member of the Emirati royal family once had us recreate the Iron Throne so he could play out his fan fiction. I usually loved seeing what my clients came up with and getting such a detailed glimpse into their fantasies, but unless this guy wanted to take a nap together, I wasn't interested. Since he had scheduled so last minute, he would simply be getting the penthouse as is, which meant it was essentially identical to the penthouse suite of a very high-end hotel. The elevator stopped and the doors slid open silently. My black Louboutin stilettos, a gift from one of my regulars, clicked on the marble floor as I walked confidently towards the living room where I could see not one but two men sitting. I sighed. This night just kept getting better. They looked up as I drew near and I instantly recognized the blonde man, but I deliberately let my eyes slide over him as though I didn't, addressing the other man instead. Good evening. I'm afraid I only have one client scheduled, but there's a very comfortable private lounge downstairs where your friend may wait until the end of the session. The man I had spoken to looked mortified and glanced back and forth to the other guy as though waiting for me to realize my mistake. I was well aware that the other gentleman was Alex Chase, one of the most famous actors on the planet, and that he probably wouldn't be here if the session wasn't for him, but my job was all about power dynamics. If I recognized him, then he started with the upper hand. "Session is with me, sweetheart," Alex Chase said, relaxing back on the couch as though this explained everything. From his expression, I should have been honored by this statement. He was America's silver screen darling. If there was a wholesome, heartthrob role to be played, he was your guy. It seemed there were some darker depths to his good boy image. There usually were. All right. So that's the first three pages.
That is the first three pages. So in a normal setting, I might actually ask the audience to chime in first with their thoughts to see what they think. But we don't have an audience here. So it's
I'm an audience.
Me and Sarah. I'll start. I think this is really interesting. My question would be, if I were asking an anonymous author, it says contemporary romance. I'm wondering if it's erotic romance because of the BDSM elements. BDSM is often associated with erotic romance. So in a query letter, if you were going to query Forever or Avon, you definitely want to make sure that they know what the book is about, just so that they understand that it actually is contemporary romance, that there's not going to be erotic elements, or it is erotic romance, and so you want to call it contemporary erotic romance because there is a difference for a publisher. There's a difference. I like the details here, but one of the things that I would say is that the details probably go on for too long. This is a lot of setup. If you can see it, it's about 2.5 pages of setup before we get to any real dialogue. And I think that there's probably some of these details are necessary for the scene setup, but I don't think all of them are necessary right here. I think some of them you can actually weave into the conversation once I think Alex Chase is going to be the hero, once the hero comes on the page. So my suggestion would be cut probably a full page of detail and get to the meeting just a little bit faster. This isn't always necessary. It's not necessary for the hero and the heroine to meet on the first page or the second page, but interaction between characters is often what kind of keeps pacing moving. So if you have a lot of narrative dialogue and a lot of background detail, that can actually be harder for the reader to feel invested. And one of the things that we talk about in the age of digital sampling is you do want to invest your readers in some way. In this case, you're kind of relating details which are interesting, but not enough to make us care about the character. If you're gonna spend time in narrative, it has to be a narrative where you're like just really like connecting the character, the point of view character to the reader. Since this is a lot of kind of details about her job and details about the business, it doesn't do that as the same way. So that's when I recommend cutting those background details and getting to the meeting sooner, and then intertwining any details that you think are still needed, and also making sure that you're giving us information not just about her job, but giving us insight into her. Getting us into her head. This is a little bit a shallower point of view, which is absolutely fine. You don't have to spend an entire book in deep point of view, but in early pages, you do want to introduce the point of view characters to the readers and help them feel emotionally connected. Other than that, the writing is actually great. It's very clean. Use some empty phrasing. You use things like who is and there was. Those are just small nitpicky things that a line editor picks up on. A reader's not going to notice, but a line editor will say, hey, you don't need to say anyone who is impolite enough. You can just say anyone impolite enough. You don't have to say there was a room. You know, you can start with other things. So empty phrasing can be pervasive, which is why I tend to point it out. I just worked with an author who used it quite a lot. So just, you know, something to look out for in the line editing stage. But other than that, the writing is very clean. Sarah, do you have anything you want to add?
No, I was actually going to say the same things about the details of like the, you know, well, we have a schoolroom, we have this, we have that. A lot of that could be seen in other scenes, or she's walking by, or sprinkled in later.
Yeah, it's funny how even I was feeling that as you were reading it. I was like, Jesus, get to the fucking point. Like, but it's such an interesting exercise to do stuff like this, because it makes you look at your writing in a different way. Yep. And when you're hearing someone else reading it, you're like, this is going on. And like, it feels sort of exciting when you're writing it, because you're world building. Yes. But that's like ego, like you're in your own space. And like, you know what's coming with the story. But for the reader, it's like they want to, especially as a romance reader, you're like, where's my hero? Like, what's going on? Or just like, who is this heroine?
Right.
Yeah.
So you're like ready to be invested. And if you take too long to get there, it's like, and that's so like all of that can easily be worked in elsewhere. Sure. Yeah.
When I, before you hit send, or whenever anybody says, what's your number one editing tip? I used to say, read your work aloud. But now I say, listen to your work, which is a little bit different. And so it's having somebody read it. You can have the computer read it to you. You can have, a program read it to you. Have your husband read it, fun romantic date night activity. there's a lot. If you know, you get to hear your heroes falling in love, and get to hear the heroine's internal thought and angst, and you get to see the characters, whether you know you have two characters or four characters or however many characters that you have as point of view characters and as protagonists. Listening to it helps you hear distinct voices and whether you've really developed the characterization, and also where you're going on too long, where you're getting bored.
Yeah, exactly.
I also had a question. You say fuck 3 times on the first page, including in the first sentence, which definitely lets you know what kind of book it's going to be. But I have similar questions on like contemporary romance, if it's going to be F-bombs all over the place, because I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'm aware that fuck is in the first sentence, but yeah. I feel like that was conscious as like I'm establishing who my heroine is. Like, this is her voice. Yeah. And I think it probably slows down from there, but
yeah.
It's an interesting book because it's not like just sex all the time. Like, it, so I think trying to figure that out as well. Like, I don't think it's heavily, heavily erotic, but I also have no concept of normal. So that's part of what I'm trying to get feedback on.
Is there pegging?
There is. the pegging could come or go. It's in there because but again, like, I think it's handled in a way I haven't seen it handled. So it's, I don't think it's a thing. Like, it's not a big deal. It's just a sort of trust thing.
Sure.
But yeah, I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think we should keep in mind that for something to be erotic romance, the eroticism has to be part of the romantic journey. It's not just about sex on page. Mm-hmm. And there can be pegging, there could be threesomes, there can be, you know, masturbation scenes and anal sex, and there can be, you know, different sexual acts. And it's not the sexual acts that make something erotic. It's actually how it's woven into the story, the explicit details. And you know, you can have something that's that they say, you know, okay, there's anal sex, but it's not erotic, and it's not could be that however it's written isn't terribly sexy. I'm not saying you would do that, but so something having sex doesn't make it erotic. It has to be how the eroticism works into their romantic and personal journeys.
Mm-hmm. I know I'm not alone, but I have a really hard time figuring out where that line is, because it feels to me like if sex is in almost any story, it should be advancing the like narrative and like telling us something about the character's journey. So people are always like, well, if you can take the sex scenes out and the story still works, that it's not erotic romance. And I'm like, but then why is it there?
I can see, I think it's a very simplified way of looking at something that's a, that's more like their sexual journey is very intertwined with their romantic journey. Whereas in a contemporary romance, you have, you can have people who are very physically attracted to each other, have amazing sexual tension and just like a really hot sex scene, but the sex is part of their relationship, but it's not a sexual journey. And in something like BDSM, it's very much about discovery and it can be about discovery and finding out who you are as a person through sex. And that makes could make it erotic romance. That's a
way better way of describing it.
I haven't heard anyone
put it like that, but yeah, if it's growth and that's part of the journey and whether it's like learning who you are or what you're into or whatever. And that, like you said, almost anytime there's BDSM, that's going to be the case because there are so many layers to that with like power dynamics in the relationship and like in trust. And out and trust and that kind of stuff. But it isn't limited to BDSM. Mm-hmm. It can be, you know, I guess, lots of other things.
Right. I don't have lived experience with the BDSM lifestyle, so I can't speak with authority and say that's always going to be the case, because I'm sure there are BDSM relationships that aren't sexual. But I'm guessing yours is going to go that way. And so it's very likely that it could be erotic romance. But I think saying if you can lift the sex scenes out is just, it's so oversimplified. It doesn't get to the nuance of why it's important.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That immediately makes so much more sense, because it's always been frustrating to me where I'm like, if you can take the sex out and the story still works, like what? How is that a thing? Like, I can't think of any book where that's true. Even if it's like barely even referenced, you know, it's in like very high level terms. You're like, I would love to see you do that with more manuscripts.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot of fun. I really like it. Not that I like tearing people's work apart or anyway, but what I like about it, especially in a group setting, is there's a really cool energy that happens where people start to think analytically about other people's work in a positive way. And learn what it's like to be a healthy critique partner, because I think being a good critique partner is actually really hard and people don't always know what that looks like. So when you're in a room doing these cold reads, you get to really demonstrate and kind of role model what it looks like to think, about how we look at something when it just hits our desk and we're just looking at the first few pages. And then also how you're going to give constructive feedback, both positive and critical, in a way that's going to help somebody improve. And also when you do this in a larger setting, you have more manuscripts, people get to see the ones where you go, actually, those are really good first three pages and I would like to see more of that. And so you get to see a wider range. But the energy and the give and take is just so much fun in a room of authors.
But it's so interesting though, seeing how deep you went just on those three pages is really fascinating, how much goes into the editorial process and how much it's almost like a second language, where you're like, oh, here are these words here. Like I wouldn't have even thought about the who is or anything like that.
Yeah. Now
it's like, oh,
back to the computer.
Oh God. It's like the day I learned that what filler words were and then did a search and like, oh, that was a bad day.
Yeah.
Good day for my manuscript, but goodness gracious. It's
an ego check for sure, where you're like, oh, I used it how many times?
It's fun, and before you hit send, people will come after doing a lesson, they'll go, oh, well, I really like the word very.
Oh, God.
Yeah. I really like the word very.
And just.
People I never looked at my manuscript in that way. And it's not... we always talk about editing and people say, I was joking about, I can find typos, I can be a proofreader. And that's a joke. But editing is a specialized skill. And there's different levels of editing. So there's proofreading and copy editing and line editing and developmental editing. And developmental editing and line editing actually are about developing this intrinsic understanding of how a story is put together and being able to shape it with an author without going back to voice, without infringing on their author voice. So it's about understanding, we need to fix the pacing, but we need to preserve these elements. And fixing pacing isn't easy. You have to understand how you're going to fix pacing. In some cases, it's, you know, it's like, okay, yeah, just get rid of some of this. And in other times, it's you have the climax of the story in the wrong moment, or you actually made the wrong choice here. I recently worked with an author, and she had the heroine make a choice, and I said, I actually really wish you hadn't sent her in this direction because it's a little too predictable, and I wish you had her be, had her do something that we wouldn't expect her to do, because you don't want the romance reader to go, oh yeah, of course she did that, because that's what every heroine does. Mm. So that's pacing. Like, part of that is pacing, and people don't think of it like that. So editing is a specialized skill, and if you can find an editor who works well with your voice, you should hold on to them with all of your might. You know, you get what you pay for. And a good editor can really elevate your book to the next level.
So when you're talking about pacing, do you actually map out stories when you're working with them, or is it all in your head? Like, when you're like, well, the climax is in the wrong place, I'm wondering how much of it you visualize physically, or if it's just a feeling you have from having read so much.
It's all in my head.
Okay.
But I have, before you hit send, and in the pacing course I teach a visual technique for doing pacing. And so I have actually done some visual kind of storyboarding so that an author can visually see why the pacing is faltering. Mm. So I don't do that unless I need to show it to the author, because I can see it in my head. But to help the author see what's on the page versus what they're hearing in their own head, I do some visual techniques.
Mm. Makes sense.
Also, I realized I should have told Jenny that I really like your writing.
Yeah, she's a very clean writer.
Yeah,
it's okay.
Well, I just wanted to make sure.
No, I'm
said
sitting
that.
Here. I'm like some kind of like constructive feedback junkie. Like, I love it when someone just opens that thing up where it's the difference between good notes and bad notes, right? Bad notes, you're kind of like, it just doesn't feel right. Good notes, you're like, of course.
Right.
Like, how did I not see this on my own? And I get like this sort of high off of it. So yeah, it's exactly what you're saying. It's like
the BDSM in you.
Might be. But
it's, well, I always tell authors and editors on both sides of the project that one of the things that can really inhibit the creative and critique process and the editing process is ego. So if you can't, as an editor, set your ego aside, because a lot of editors get really tied up in, I have to be right and you have to listen to me. And don't want they don't think the author should argue, and they're just gonna make the changes. And then on the other side, an author can be like, I don't need to be edited. I'm just doing this so I can say I had edits, but really I'm not gonna take any edits. So if either party can't set their ego aside, the editorial process does not work, and the book doesn't get better. So it is like, we all have to learn how to set aside that kind of possessive ego. I'm the best, and just dive into the creative process.
That's funny. I've been I have a fantasy novel that I'm rewriting for YA, and one thing I've realized in the process that's kind of exciting me is that I'm able to cut a huge amount of words just from like cutting my repetition and like getting over my precious self. And I'm like, oh, that's a really good sentence. And I'm like, but you already said it before. And so like, I've just been going through line by line, and it's painstaking, and like, it makes me want to rip my hair out. But I feel excited about the fact that I'm going to improve as a writer now that I've realized that I can cut like thousands of words just by like really reining myself in. It is this sense you're like, ooh, like, what's this going to mean? Like, it's going to make everything better. There is a level of excitement.
Well, I like the idea that it builds, like, you, as soon as you've pointed out the filler or the empty phrasing, like, I will now be super aware of that, and like, it will make me better as a writer going forward. Like, I'm guessing if you put your ego aside and you can take constructive feedback, then you get to grow and like deal with that less as you go down your writing journey. But I don't see how any author in like early manuscripts could be like, you need that feedback. You can't see it in your own work. I don't know. Maybe there's some people who just are like story geniuses, but
they don't, like, they don't teach this even in writing courses in general. I feel like it's mechanics, but I hadn't heard the empty phrasing before as even a concept. I hadn't heard of filler words as a concept until other writers told me about it. Yeah. And I've done a lot of writing through, you know, grad school, mm-hmm. you know, and no one ever really reins you in.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think people really like about Before You Hit Send is it's very relatable. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not high concept writing ideals. It's here's just some real like nitty gritty mechanics and things that you can look for. And those, like, I can't teach voice, you know, so part of that is I can help you polish the story. I can help you work on pacing. I can help you reduce overwriting. But you have to find your own voice in that whole process. And one of the things of finding your voice is also not trying to edit every single thing out. I was warn authors about that because it can be so tempting to try and make the story perfect by fiddling with the mechanics. And then you have something that becomes a little bit soulless.
By taking all the fucks out, you mean?
I'm not saying take all the fucks out.
Leave my fucks alone. J.R. Ward said I could say fuck.
I'm just saying there's three on the first page and none after that.
I don't know if you've noticed, but Jenny actually does like the word fuck. So
she does like the word fuck.
I'm a fan. Don't take it from me. You could pry it out of my fucking fingers. Are there any other like sort of aspiring authors, would that be your advice? Like learn to self-edit.
So my advice to aspiring authors is to read a lot and to read things that are selling well and to read things that aren't selling that well, to read in your genre and outside your genre, to read outside your comfort zone, to read very widely, not just white authors, not just black authors, not just LGBTQ authors, but read widely. So I think reading is very important because it can teach you a lot about craft. I use a lot of different authors as examples of different craft techniques, like Nalini Singh. I use Nalini Singh as an example a lot. But also taking craft courses, or if you don't like craft courses, then reading craft books, or listening to the RWA workshops, which this year in particular, I notice, are really tremendous subjects. So you can learn a lot. Also finding good critique partners, I think.
Yeah, that was gonna be my next question. Is there a good way to do that for people? Like, it's hard, right?
It is hard. You know, I think as you get involved in RWA chapters, you start to meet people. If you don't have a local chapter, there's online chapters. Social media, actually, you can start to find critique partners. Mm-hmm. If you interact with people, you know, you can a lot. I've seen people say, hey, I'm looking for critique partners. Anybody interested? I think Absolute Right, their forum, they do some critique partner matchups, yeah. And the same with Romance Divas. So there are places that you can find critique partners. Finding a good critique partner, I make no promises about that.
Yeah. Well, that was what was, we talked to Abby Jimenez yesterday, and she was saying she'd been on, what was the website? It was like
Critique Circle, maybe?
Critique Circle something or something. Like, and like everyone had been giving her lots of feedback on her writing. And then like as she got farther into the journey, it was like not necessarily good advice, and she mm-hmm. had to undo that. And yep. It was like, yeah, how do you know? Like, you have credentials. Sure. I trust you. And it feels right. But like if you're a brand new writer and someone is giving you advice, like, yeah, how do you know it's good advice?
Yeah, it's not easy. Take it before you hit send, because actually it before you hit send does teach you to be a good critique partner and to recognize as good versus bad advice. And I laugh about that, but it's one of like it gives you a knowledge base so that you can go, oh, actually that person isn't as familiar with craft as I thought they were. Mm. It's, you know, if you exchange pages, say, hey, let's see if we're a good fit before we commit to this, and exchange like a couple chapters and read and say, you know what? I actually don't think I'm a good fit for your work because XYZ, you can be nice about it, but you don't have to like take the first critique partner that comes along. You don't need 10 critique partners. You just need a couple that you trust. So it's a process. It's a process like kind of like dating.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
I also tend to recommend, like, I feel like I've lucked into having some very talented writer friends. Like Jenny reads my stuff. My friend Sarah Tarkoff reads my stuff. But one of my other beta readers isn't a writer at all. Mm-hmm. She just reads voraciously. And so I often tell people, if you want someone's opinion, like something feels wrong or like the pacing or things like that, often someone can just get it on a gut level just having read it. They'll know something is wrong. So like, even if you don't know anyone and live in a vacuum, there's probably an avid reader near you who would like to take a look. Mm-hmm. They might not know the craft, but she still gives excellent
They
notes.
Can't tell you how to fix it, but they can tell you
they can tell you something's wrong.
Right. Yeah. And then sometimes that's just as helpful as saying, here's how you fix it. Because even in the editor-author relationship, if I say, this isn't right, I don't necessarily say, fix it this way.
Right.
Mm. I'll say, this needs work, and something, because it's awkward, there's a bad transition, but I won't say, here's how you fix it. So even in the editor-author relationship, that doesn't happen, even with somebody who's got credentials, as you say.
Yeah.
We still let the author lead that process. Mm-hmm.
I was just saying, another resource that helped me when I was starting out was a Print Run podcast, which is run by two literary agents from Red Sofa, and they do first page critique episodes and query episodes, and they do the same sort of thing where you talk through it. So I think you should do the podcast for all the first pages, because they only do that like once every month.
Well, and I want to hear it for romance specifically, with like that romance brain and the amount of experience.
Yeah. I'll have to look into that. Maybe I can get some guests to come and help me critique. I might know a few editors.
One or two. Yeah. Well, awesome. We want to be conscious of your time, but thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks for having me.
Great.